Good evening. It's wonderful to be with you again. It is February 5th, 2024, just as I start, the fridge shuts off the compressor. That is, shut off, which is great for the sound, audio quality. Oh, magnificent. I didn't expect that. Didn't know, but it's 1748 hours Eastern Standard Time. This February 5th, day of February 2024 of the Common Era. Ward Green with you again, as I probably already said. Now, I've got audio turned on. That's the main thing. The father of Moses, Amram, in the Arabian tradition, is Pharaoh's private bodyguard. It seems a little bit unusual. Now, that may not be actually true to life, but it's a myth of some kind, or it's a tradition of some kind. It's not just a myth. It's a tradition, but it's sort of mythological because it's not associated. It's never anything that's not got chronological dates, you know, or a chronology. We have a chronology, but that doesn't mean that the story in the Arab tradition had a chronology. They didn't say that in the year such and such, Amram began to be the Pharaoh's private bodyguard, so we don't have a date. So it's more like a myth, but it's their tradition. So there's something more than just myth there. Probably it's as true of all myths, they have something important to say. So Moses' father was the private bodyguard of the Pharaoh Apophis? That sounds incredible, but let's just read. And he's living, Amram, the father of Moses, is living in Pharaoh's residence. Pharaoh's residence. Already, at the time when Moses is born, in other words, it says, at this time, Pharaoh tells all of his officers to put away their wives, but the angel Gabriel brings Amram's wife into the chamber where Amram is standing guard. In other words, they conceive a baby when Amram is on guard duty, it sounds like it from that, whilst Pharaoh is sleeping. And sometime following this is Moses born to a joyful mother. In other words, they conceived together, had sexual intercourse, had a child. To conceal him, Moses is put in the oven. Here's the dramatic part of the story. To conceal him, Moses is put in the oven when he's born. He's kept in the oven, I guess during the daytime or whenever the Pharaoh's around. And when it gets accidentally turned on by his sister, his mother discovers it to her horror that the oven's been turned on. Now, in the Arab tradition, the baby is some kind of miracle worker because he's able to withstand the fact that the oven was turned on. In other words, the mother's horrified because it's turned on and because maybe the baby should have been burned but wasn't, based on how long the oven was on. Maybe that was what it was. It's not clear. They didn't have electric ovens in those days. It's not clear exactly what all the details are. But Moses then requests the other thing that's miraculous. The baby from inside the oven requests her assistance when she opens the oven. Or something like that. But it's described in such a way that the baby didn't request her assistance before she opened the oven. And so there's something miraculous about it, apparently. That's an amazing story, isn't it? I just find that incredible. Phenomenal. That's the end of our study of the Arabian tradition for today. It's called an Arabian tradition, and it's in the Crucible article, C cubed, Crucible of Credible Creed by yours truly. And it's just after chapter 6, paragraph 6, that this insert is found. An Arabian tradition, Moses adopted by Pharaoh as a baby. So let's bring this back over here where we can read it, where we can read some things more easily when we change tabs here. I want to change the tab. Let's look at the next tab. This is the discussion of why Hezekiah's year one. It's in the table, at the end of the table, H4. It's an addendum to the table, I guess. And then there's a list of all the kings, all the lists of the historic kings of Israel and Judah, giving their dates. So it's like a history with dates. In other words, histories have dates. They don't just have names. So the Bible is not in itself a history, whereas we have a chronology that we've developed called the genealogy, which explains how the Bible is really a history, because we can put dates on it. Now, why Hezekiah's first year is a part of this table, why his first year can be no lower nor higher than 725, and note in this table, Jerusalem's destruction, I say here, is 586, but we've now changed our minds and said it's not 586, it's 587. So that date, 587, is what we're adding this number to. But now when we look at the numbers of all the reign lengths of these kings, 55 years and so on, down to the final king Zedekiah, who was 10 years and some months. It was 10 years and 5 months, not 10 years and 10 months. I think that's a mistake there. But anyway, let's ignore the months. So 10 years, let's assume that the 3-month reigns were included in the reign of in the last year of the previous king. So the 3 months will be ignored. And the 5 months at the end of the 10 years of Zedekiah is also ignored because it falls in the same calendar year. We're just trying to determine how many years in our calendar. And since they both fall in the same calendar year, it's the 5th month when the temple's destroyed, which is sometime in the summer. It's in the same calendar year as the beginning of his reign in the spring. The first month of the Jewish year, the sacred year, being right around the time of vernal equinox, as we've already discussed before many times. But 10 years plus 11, we have, going backwards from Zedekiah, 10 plus 11 plus 31. So 10 and 11 is 21, plus 31 is 52, plus 2 is 54, plus 55 is 109 years total, not 110. So that's why we can still get the same answer when we have the destruction in 587, because we have now add 109 years and we get 696 for the last year of Hezekiah, or the first year of Manasseh. That means the last year of Hezekiah would be the year before that, of course. But when we add the 29 years of Hezekiah to the 696, we get 725, exactly. So we're not changing that when we change the 587, or change Jerusalem's destruction from 586 to 587 BCE. So that's good. Now, the reign of Merodach-Baladan ending in 710, that's amazing. We're going to read about that today in the book of 2 Kings chapter 20. The solar eclipse also, it's discussed here. You should read this if you're interested in why the solar eclipse can, how it can be explained. It's not mentioned in the Bible, but how the changing of the shadow in the book of 2 Kings in the chapter that we're going to read today. That movement of the shadow that went backwards on the stairs of Ahaz. The stairs of Ahaz, you see, can be considered to be, and is considered by at least one translation, the American Standard Version. That version considers the stairs of Ahaz as being a very accurate sundial. So the steps of the stairs of Ahaz being a sundial, if the sun goes backwards on those stairs, it's going backwards on the sundial, backwards in time. So it's making, the effect is that the sun has moved backwards in time. And we explain in that chapter how that can be the case. It's easy to explain it. It's easy to read it, but we just don't have enough time to be sure we can read it. If we have time, maybe we'll come back. So today's proverb, little children, isn't this exciting to learn? I mean, you could see how we could spend hours studying the eclipse and studying the idea that maybe an eclipse could cause a sundial to move, the shadow, that is, of the sundial to move back. That, and it could have been a cloud that could do that. A cloud moving across the sun could make... So since a cloud could cause it, we don't know what caused it, but it's pretty easy to see that it's still miraculous if it was prophesied and then it happened. And it was prophesied. But let's wait till we read that today. For right now, Proverbs 21, verse 4. Haughty eyes and an arrogant heart, the lamp of the wicked ones are sin. The interesting thing, so that's today's proverb, little children. I'm all excited. I can't talk. I want to rush ahead all the time. But haughty eyes, we have so much to cover. But haughty eyes and an arrogant heart, the lamp of the wicked ones are sin. That suggests, well, we can have everything else can be haughty, but except for our eyes, and everything else about us can be arrogant except for our heart. At least that's one interpretation, which shows that Jehovah's very, not lenient, but he's merciful. He gives us a way out, a way to, we can be haughty as long as our eyes are not haughty, and we can be arrogant as long as our heart is not arrogant. It's fascinating, isn't it, to interpret it that way? Because otherwise we'd be really in trouble if we couldn't be any, if we had no leeway. Let's go back to... Let's get to our reading. Get to the reading, 2 Kings 20. In those days, Hezekiah got sick to the point of dying. This is right at the time when the army of Assyria is outside the gates. Okay? Just after they've left, sometime right around that same time. In those days, Hezekiah got sick to the point of dying. Accordingly, Isaiah, the son of Amoz, the prophet, we'll see exactly what it says, came into him and said to him, "This is what Jehovah has said. Give commands to your household, for you yourself will indeed die and will not live." And here's proof right here that prophets are not always correct, because prophecies don't always come true, because Hezekiah was told he was going to die and not live. At that, he turned his face to the wall and began to pray to Jehovah. And as we're going to see, he doesn't end up dying. Saying, "I beseech you, O Jehovah, remember, please, how I have walked before you in truthfulness and with a complete heart." Look at that, the complete heart. And we just read about the heart. "And what was good in your eyes I have done." And Hezekiah began to weep profusely. And it came about that Isaiah himself had not yet gone out to the middle court when Jehovah's word itself came to him, saying, "Go back, and you must say to Hezekiah, the leader of my people Israel, this is what Jehovah, the God of David, your forefather, has said. I have heard your prayer. I have seen your tears. Here I am healing you. On the third day you will go up to the house of Jehovah, and I shall certainly add 15 years to your days. And out of the palm of the king of Assyria I shall deliver you in this city. And I will defend this city for my own sake and for the sake of David, my servant." Well, you could see that perhaps Jehovah didn't say you were going to die tomorrow either. When Jehovah said, "Give commands to your household, for you yourself will indeed die and will not live." But it wasn't urgent to give commands to his household if he was going to live, for if he would and was going to, if he would be going to, and it, or if he was going to live for 15 more years, why would he give commands to his household? So we see that sometimes things change. The prophecy was given, but it didn't come true. Then another prophecy was given. In other words, prophets are not always right. So Jehovah was merciful when David prayed, but David had to pray, though, to receive that mercy. And Isaiah went, not David, he's a descendant of David, his Hezekiah, the, you know, one of the sons of David. He's a descendant in the line of David, who became the king after David. David was king in 1058 BCE in our chronology, and Hezekiah is king in 725. Those are the starting dates. And Isaiah went on to say, "You men, take a cake of pressed dried figs." So they took and put it upon the boil, after which he gradually revived. Meantime, Hezekiah said to Isaiah, "What is the sign that Jehovah will heal me, and I shall certainly go up on the third day to the house of Jehovah?" To this Isaiah said, "This is the sign for you from Jehovah, that Jehovah will perform the word that he has spoken. Shall the shadow actually go forward 10 steps of the stairs, or should it go back 10 steps? Then Hezekiah said, "It is an easy thing for the shadow to extend itself 10 steps, but not that the shadow should go backward 10 steps. At that, Isaiah the prophet began to call out to Jehovah, and he made the shadow that had gone down gradually go back on the steps. That is, on the steps of the stairs of Ahaz, 10 steps backward. And we've mentioned how that in the, what version was it? American Revised? American Standard? American Revised? American Standard Version. Right. It was considered that the stairs of Ahaz, in the American Standard Version, ASV, were referred to a sundial of an accurate kind. "It is an easy thing for the shadow to go forward, but not backward," Hezekiah said. At that time, but then at that, in verse 11, Isaiah the prophet began to call out to Jehovah, and he made the shadow that had gone down gradually go back on the steps, that is, on the steps of the stairs of Ahaz, 10 steps backward. I'm not sure if I read that part twice or not, but I wanted to make sure we read verse 11. At that time, listen to this, Merodach-Baladan, who's also known as Merodach-Baladan, for some reason the letters occasionally get altered in the ancient languages, but Merodach-Baladan is well known as the king of Babylon, who ruled until 710. So in other words, he was only... And then he ruled again for a brief 9 months in 703 BCE, sometime in that vicinity. So the people who say that the Assyrians attacked Jerusalem in 703, they would have Merodach-Baladan sending letters and a gift to Hezekiah after he recovered his rulership in 703, whereas we say, in our chronology, it has to happen in 710. Or before 710, in 711, when Hezekiah, or right around this time, before 710, before, at least before Merodach-Baladan loses his kingship, he sent letters and a gift to Hezekiah. In our chronology, it's in 710 or 711, and not in 703. But does it seem more reasonable that a man would, as a king, would send letters and a gift if he just was receiving his kingship again, after having lost it for some 7 years, and then he only rules for 9 months, would he be able to, or is it more likely that he would send a gift and letters if he'd already been ruling for 11 years, which was the case from 721? See, he began to rule at the death, or 722, on the death of Shalmaneser V, the one who initiated the siege of Samaria, as we talked about, or at least according to the Bible, he initiated it. And in our chronology, that happened in 721 BCE. He initiated, or was it 722, actually? 722 in our chronology? Yeah, I think so. 722 in our chronology. That's right. So Shalmaneser was ruling in 722, but he died shortly thereafter, and Merodach-Baladan, or Merodach-Baladan, the king of Babylon, he became king after the death of Shalmaneser. That's the, when you read the accounts of history, that's what they say. So we know the dating of these things. They're conventional dates. It's just that they have another date when Merodach-Baladan ruled for another 9 months later. But this is where he sent letters and a gift. Doesn't it sound more reasonable that after ruling for 11 years, he'd send letters and a gift to another king because he'd feel like he could do that having ruled for 10 years or more? Sounds more reasonable, doesn't it? For he had heard that Hezekiah had been sick. And he felt like, well, he'd been already been king for 10 years. It sounds reasonable that he would feel like he had an obligation or he would reach out to Hezekiah. Other people argue other things, but, you know, they have their own... Their chronology forces them to think of it differently, right? And to reason it differently. And Hezekiah proceeded to listen to them and show them all his treasure house, the silver and the gold and the balsam oil and the good oil, and to the messengers, that is, of Merodach-Baladan, and his armory and all that was to be found in his treasures. There proved to be nothing that Hezekiah did not show them in his own house and in all his dominion. He showed these visitors all these things. And they were foreigners, right? Visitors from another country. After that, Isaiah the prophet, and we'll see what we read in Ezekiel, hopefully. We'll see compare what that says in today's Ezekiel reading, chapter 44. Compare that to this, and it has a lot in common here. And again, I didn't plan any of this. Jehovah's allowing all these things to line up because he wrote the Bible, but he also allowed it to have verse numbers that were allocated according to a certain scheme that no one could know how it would work out except for him. But anyway, it's remarkable, the correspondences, as you will hopefully see. Verse 14, so after Hezekiah showed all his treasures to these foreigners, Isaiah the prophet came into King Hezekiah and said to him, after that is, what did these men say, and from where did they proceed to come to you? So Hezekiah said, from a distant land they came, from Babylon. You know, Babylon's to the east of Jerusalem. Let's see now, Jerusalem's 3 hours east. Also, when you look at the eclipse, Here's the illustration of the eclipse. I have it here somewhere. The actual eclipse that we talked about that could have affected the sundial. You see, it's given as like 9 o'clock when it passes Jerusalem. It's right about 9 o'clock, but that's Greenwich time. You have to add 3 hours to that because Jerusalem's 3 hours east of Greenwich. Is that true? Or Babylon's 3 hours east of Greenwich. Maybe Jerusalem's 2 hours. I think that might be right. Whatever it is, it's close to noontime when this eclipse is, right? Babylon is 3 hours, I believe that's right, east of Greenwich. I just can't remember whether Jerusalem is 2 or 3 hours east. But since Jerusalem is very close to being, you know, in... Well, let's look at that other thing again, the map. Yeah, right here. See, we look at this map. This is the eclipse, right? We just zoom in on it. Okay, well, I know. We look at the same thing. We just need to shrink it. Shrink it down. Okay. We can see it right here. Egypt. We already had it right here. Egypt and Jerusalem are very close. But, you see, yeah, both Jerusalem and Babylon are 3 hours east. That's what it is. Of Greenwich, which is over here in, you know, London, England, somewhere in England, in Britain. It's not London, I don't think, but wherever it is. Anyway, it might be London. I can't remember where Greenwich is, what part of Britain, but it doesn't sound like London, does it? But anyway, in Egypt, see, this is 30 degrees longitude right here at the Nile River. So, and Jerusalem is therefore just past that. And 30 degrees means 2 hours, 15 degrees per hour. So 2 hours compared to, you know, just past that to the east would be 3 hours east of Greenwich. So that's why we add 3 hours to 9 o'clock and we get 12 o'clock noon for the time of that eclipse. Why that would help or hurt or anything? It's just that it's easier to see an eclipse around that time, perhaps, maybe. They're more noticeable at the brightest time of the day. If you get an eclipse, you can see the light dimming, right? But note, okay, there's nothing that Hezekiah didn't show them. And so Hezekiah said, from a distant land they came, from Babylon. And Isaiah said, what did they see in your house? Hezekiah said, everything that is in my house they saw. There proved to be nothing that I did not show them in my treasures. Isaiah now said to Hezekiah, hear the word of Jehovah. Look, days are coming, and all that is in your house, your own house, and that your forefathers have stored up down to this day will actually be carried to Babylon. Nothing will be left, Jehovah has said. And some of your own sons will come forth from you, to whom you will become father will themselves be taken and actually become court officials. They will become court officials in the palace of the king of Babylon. We're running out of time here if I'm not careful, so I'm trying to speed this up. At that, King Hezekiah said to Isaiah, "The word of Jehovah that you have spoken is good." And he went on to say, "Is it not so if peace and truth themselves will continue in my own days?" Right. So Hezekiah was a little bit selfish, perhaps. He said, as long as things are good in my lifetime, it doesn't matter to me if they haul the rest of us off to Babylon later on. As for the rest of the affairs of Hezekiah and all his mightiness and how he made the pool and the conduit and then brought the water into the city. He made this amazing conduit for the water to be received into the city, this remarkable tunnel. And are they not written in the book of the affairs of the days of the kings of Judah? It's still there to this day, I believe. You can still go to Jerusalem and see this water tunnel that Hezekiah, you know, he carved it through the solid rock. And it's quite lengthy. It's quite a magnificent engineering feat. Finally, Hezekiah lay down with his forefathers, and Manasseh, his son, began to reign in place of him. Let's read Ezekiel before we run out of time and before I talk, you know, someone's ear off. And he proceeded to bring me back by way of the gate of the sanctuary. Ezekiel writes, "The outer one facing east, and it was shut." Now, this is interesting. Little children, then Jehovah said to me, "As regards this gate, shut is how it will continue. It will not be opened, and no mere man will come in by it, for Jehovah himself, the God of Israel, has come in by it, and it must continue shut. However, the chieftain, as chieftain, he himself will sit in it," in the gate, that is, "in order to eat bread before Jehovah. By way of the porch of the gate he will come in, and by way of it he will go out." So they had gates that had porches, and then they had a door in the porch. You could go in through the porch or in through the gate if you needed to bring larger wagons, you know, anything like a large wagon or any wagon. You have to come in through the gate, but a man could come in through the porch. "And he now brought me by way of the north gate to before the house that I might see. And look, the glory of Jehovah had filled the house of Jehovah. So some of the other gates would be open, but not the east gate. And I went falling on my face. Then Jehovah said to me, 'Son of man, set your heart and see with your eyes and with your ears. Hear all that I am speaking with you regarding all the statutes of the house of Jehovah and regarding all its laws, and you must set your heart upon the entryway of the house with all the exits of the sanctuary, and you must say to rebelliousness, to the house of Israel, or to the rebellious people, or the rebellious house, according to the Septuagint, this is what to, you say to the house of Israel, this is what the sovereign Lord Jehovah has said, that is enough of you because of all your detestable things, O house of Israel. When you bring in the foreigners, uncircumcised in heart." See, remember in the book of Kings, 2 Kings 20, Hezekiah brought in the foreigners. And here it's mentioning it in the book of Ezekiel. I didn't plan any of this. "When you bring in the foreigners, uncircumcised in heart." Now, maybe my subconscious mind knew that if I chose a certain book and chapter and started reading in chapter 1 that these things would all line up, but how could someone's brain do that? I don't think it's very likely. It's got to be some divine thing that Jehovah arranges. "But when you bring in the foreigners," he says, "uncircumcised in heart and uncircumcised in flesh, in order to come to be in my sanctuary so as to profane it, even my house, when you present my bread, fat, and blood, while they keep breaking my covenant on account of all your detestable things," meaning the priests are breaking the covenant, not the foreigners. You wouldn't expect the foreigners to observe the covenant. "Neither have you taken care of the obligation of my holy things, nor would you post others as caretakers of my obligation in my sanctuary for yourselves." The obligation they didn't take care of the obligation of the holy things, and they didn't post anyone to take care of those obligations. This is what the Sovereign Lord Jehovah has said. No foreigner, uncircumcised in heart. You see, the heart is coming in again. And we read about the heart in the proverb for today, which is randomly chosen. Uncircumcised in heart and uncircumcised in flesh. No foreigner may come into my sanctuary, that is, any foreigner who is in the midst of the sons of Israel. So here he's only talking, though, about the foreigners who were in the midst of the sons of Israel, whereas in Hezekiah, in the case of Hezekiah, he allowed people who were foreigners from a distant land to come in, which was even worse, of course. But as for the Levites who got far away from me when Israel, who wandered away from me, wandered after their dungy idols, they must also bear their error, and in my sanctuary they must become ministers at posts of oversight over the gates of the house and ministers at the house. These Levites, they're not the priests, they're Levites, and they themselves will slaughter the whole burnt offering and the sacrifice for the people, and they themselves will stand before them to minister to them. Now, did the priests do the sacrificing? I think the Levites probably did do that, but I can't remember. Let's see if we can find a reference. Oh, here in verse 34 of Chronicles, 2 Chronicles 29, verse 34, only the priests themselves happened to be too few, and they were not able to skin all the burnt offerings. See that? So the brothers of Levites helped out. That's interesting. So yeah, the priests were supposed to do the slaughtering. And they themselves, these Levites, will stand before them to minister to them. That is, the people, stand before the people. For the reason that they kept ministering to them before their dungy idols, and became to the house of Israel a stumbling block into error, that is why I have raised my hand against them as the utterance of the Sovereign Lord Jehovah, and they must bear their error. Well, we've run out of time. But he said, I shall make them caretakers, verse 14, and as for the Levitical priests, the sons of Zadok, who took care of the obligation of my sanctuary, when the sons of Israel wandered away from me, these priests who took care of the obligation will now come near to me to minister to me, and they must stand before me to present to me fat, and the blood is the utterance of the Sovereign Lord Jehovah. We don't have enough time to read all of it. There's a lot of it, but they are the ones that will come into my sanctuary, verse 16, and they will come near to my table and to minister to me, and they must take care of the obligation to me. And they wear linen here, right? They weren't allowed. It's fascinating. Some of the things you learn from this, they had to clip the hair of their heads. It's just like, this is why people cut their hair short, because the priests had to do that. It explains these things. It's the end of our study. It's February 5th, 2024 of the Common Era. It's great to be with you again. It's 18:21 hours Eastern Standard Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. On my behalf, this is Live Dusty, still keeping good time, an automatic watch, and Cassie, my digital battery-powered watch, saying bye for now.